We've come to the point of, you know, where we now turn to your questions. But before that, I would like to take a moment to recognize our question review team, the people that are responsible for selecting the questions that are presented to our speakers. I ask you to please hold your applause while I introduce them. Julie Copeland, who's the city editor of Santa Cruz Sentinel. Fran Gaver, who's an attorney with Leach Walker and one of our veteran members. Doug McKnight, who's a reporter for KAZU Radio. Don Miller, who's an executive editor of the Monterey Herald and Santa Cruz Sentinel. If you'd give them a hand, I'd appreciate it. We also did our student forum, and we have with us a group of students that represent those that attended our student forum. It was a great forum, great student questions. I'd like to ask all of the students that are here to please stand, if they would, and remain standing until I recognize the schools that they represent. Thank you very much. The students are from the Defense Language Institute, the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, Monta Vista Christian School, Monterey High School, the Navy Postgraduate School, and Santa Clara University. This afternoon, we, as always, you can sit down, guys. We had a wonderful turnout of the students. The program is possible because of the generous support that we get from our series sponsors. And Sylvia and I, along with the Panetta Institute Board of Directors, would really like to express our grateful thanks for the sponsorship that allows these students from across the Central Coast to be able to participate in this program. So I'd appreciate it if you give the sponsors a hand.
All right. So yeah. Let me preface my remarks by saying that I think that Commissioner Kelly is a hero on a whole bunch of levels. And in his 40 years, what happened in New York City to actually professionalize the department, to make the department more inclusive, to increase training, all those things are real, and I do believe contributed to the significant drop in crime. With that said, you can tell we totally disagree on stop and frisk. And this is what I would say. This is the hard part, right? If you look at what makes it constitutionally questionable, it says, right, if you go into the actual decision, that you've got to be stopping basically somebody for a reason. And yet, what do we know, right? And it's very likely that increased reporting are part of the increase. But the stats are the stats, right? When Amadou Diallo was killed, there was less than 100,000 stop and frisks in...
Reported
in the city, right? And if you say a lot of that, I would actually defer to you on that. But just follow me. There's less than 100. About, you know, statistically within the margin of error, about 90% of the people are people of color, right? High 80s are people of color. About 90% are not charged with anything. They're what we refer to in the vernacular as innocent. 700 guns, give or take, taken off the street. Fast forward, there's 680,000 reported. About 90%, give or take, are people of color. About 90% are innocent. And there's 700 guns taken off the street. Mayor Bloomberg was, I would say, appropriately fanatical about gun control. He was very clear that a lot of this was about taking care of unsafe people. The stop and frisk go up almost 700% their previous level, and not one more gun comes off the street. I come out of the religious-based organizing tradition in New York City, a church in New York City called St. Mary's. I can tell you, our little church coalition could get 700 guns off the street with a good buyback program that would be a lot shorter and actually uplift the community. Now, here's the other tough part we have to deal with, right? As the homicides have come down in New York City, the homicide case close rate hasn't gone up the way you would expect it would, right? The rape case close rate hasn't gone up the way you would expect it would. In our community, it is not enough for us to have an honest conversation about the crime rate and who may be getting killed. And so we also have to talk about why aren't more homicides getting solved if there's fewer homicides? Why aren't more rapes getting solved if there are fewer homicides? I would go back to my previous example. When the officer, searching for the rape suspect, decided to stop and frisk four girls, he stopped looking for the rape suspect. It's a massive distraction. It's a good PR campaign on the Upper East Side, but for the rest of the city, it's a massive distraction that does not make us more safe. Everything else you did made us more safe. That does not.
Okay, let's, we got a lot of areas to cover here, and I'm just gonna ask you to try to keep your answers as short as possible as we go through it. I did wanna ask about the Stand Your Ground laws. We've got almost 23 states that have Stand Your Ground laws, and as you know, that just, I think basically it means you don't have to retreat. You can basically use lethal force if you think you're threatened in certain ways. Trayvon Martin case basically came, I think that was the defense in the Trayvon Martin case as well. The argument is obviously that the Attorney General said this is a dangerous expansion of the concept of self-defense. Others have argued that it's a concept that, you know, not only protects whites but blacks as well, because when someone is threatened and the police are delayed in getting there, it gives them the opportunity to protect themselves. Who's right?
Who's right is like 1,000 years of Western tradition on the notion of self-defense. The way that we've evolved as a civilization over the years is that you actually have a responsibility to retreat. And if you cannot retreat, then you have the right to defend yourself. And so we've had this kind of standing erosion. You start with sort of self-defense as it's evolved across the centuries. The NRA creates something called the Castle Doctrine. The Castle Doctrine says, if you come onto my property, and I tell you to get off my property, and you don't get off, and I feel threatened, I can shoot and kill you on my property. Stop and frisk takes the Castle Doctrine to the street. It basically is a license for cowards to shoot people they're afraid of. Let me repeat that. It is a license for cowards to shoot people they're afraid of. What it says is that if you have a kind of like reasonable fear that somebody might be about to hurt you, you can shoot and kill them. And so there have been cases in Florida, prosecutors complain about this, where you have two drug dealers walking down the street, both packing guns. You can get them on a weapons charge, but you can't get them on homicide because both of them felt reasonably afraid of the other, and then they start shooting out. In other words, this is the way that the NRA licenses the return of the Wild West to streets across this country. We, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, should have a few things that we all hold sacred. And one of them is the very notion of civilization. And it is actually at its core, one of the core principles is the point to which we've evolved on self-defense.
Ray, what's your view on this?
I'm against Stand Your Ground. I think it's confusing. I think it leads to murders, excused murders. A lot of these confrontations are one-on-one. You just don't know what happened there. And I think the concept has long been in the common law that you can defend your castle, your home. You don't have to retreat in your home. But I think, clearly, the Stand Your Ground laws are just problematic, and I think most law enforcement people believe that.
Okay, first question here. Could we as a nation demilitarize police forces and return to the Irish cop walking the precinct and knowing the
sounds
folks,
like
knowing the folks on the block.
Racial profiling.
Actually, that's what happened to Irish before there were Irish cops.
Let me just for those of you that are not aware of this, it does go back almost 45 years, and it was basically came out of a comprehensive drug abuse prevention and control act of 1970. Where they started doing joint missions together. Then the Defense Authorization Bill began to provide a transfer of excess military gear, the so-called 1033 program, that provides this excess gear to the police departments. And you know the arguments for. The argument is cops are now dealing with terrorism, they're dealing with gangs, they're dealing with people that bring a lot of firepower to the streets, and they need to have this kind of technology in order to confront that. Those that are against think that the image of armored cars and SWAT teams obviously impacts on the relationship between the community and the police force itself. What are your views on militarization?
I'm against it. I think it was well-intentioned. There's a lot of excess equipment, certainly after Iraq and Afghanistan. We have a lot of it, and it made sort of sense to give it to police agencies, but I think the optics are very bad. You saw it in Ferguson. It's just inappropriate for local police agencies to have these weapons of war on the street, in my mind. I think they can be stored or warehoused, perhaps at a state level, perhaps at a county level, if in fact they're needed. But they shouldn't be used for regular patrol. That's not what we're about as a country. We don't use the military, the army, to do civil policing. So.
Okay. 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a key section of the Voting Rights Act, which required certain states to receive federal permission in order to change voting rules. Do you believe this was the correct decision, given the that Chief Justice Roberts' conclusion that the U.S. Has changed and therefore it was not necessary?
I'll give that to the head of the NAACP.
You know, look, what Roberts did was essentially the bidding of a certain class of Southerners who have bristled under the Voting Rights Act for half a century. And the reality is that if you look at the present history of voting irregularities in places like Alabama and Florida and Mississippi, and the states have tremendous problems. The fact that we have a black president is because the Voting Rights Act was in effect during his election, not despite it. And that's as somebody who has fought at the ground level in states across this country. We as a country have to understand that we are living through a moment of national anxiety. Our nation will be a nation only of minorities within most of our lifetimes, about 30 years. That means that every group in our society will have to get along with at least one other group demographically in order to succeed democratically. And many of us see great hope in that because we come from communities, be they Irish or Italian or black or Latino, who have frankly, at the end of the day, in most places, always had to do that. And we think it's probably healthy that everybody be able to do that on some level, have to do that. But for other folks, they're very worried. And the tell in a voting rights debate, and it goes back to the very beginning of the country. My father's here. He descends from 8 Revolutionary War soldiers, and we have a long oral tradition in our family on that side. My mom descends from 2 black statesmen during Reconstruction, a long oral tradition on that side as well. My grandmother's 99 years old, and she's sharp as a tack, and she carries about 200 years of stories. And when you listen to those stories and you read the history, what you see is this. Right after the Civil War, we were similarly anxious. There was a big wave of immigrants of color. There were Chinese, and we got the Chinese Exclusion Act as a result. And there was a strengthening black vote throughout the Southeast. And so we responded with, you know, these pushing people out of the country the way that we have essentially Latino Exclusion Acts throughout across the South. And we responded with voter suppression. But the arguments then were the same arguments that had been made right after the Revolutionary War against poor white men. You see, you have to remember, we have excluded blacks, Latinos, Native Americans, Asians, all women, and at the end of the Revolutionary War, white men who didn't own land from voting various times in our society. And what did John Adams say? What did John Adams say when Thomas Paine was so ticked off and saying, why can't we vote? Why won't you let the privates in the Revolutionary Army vote? They were the backbone of the revolution. What did he say? He said, that would not be democracy. That would be mobocracy. Those men don't own any land. They're not tied to any jurisdiction. They can move from town to town and steal elections. That was the tell. They always say it's vote security. They said that we couldn't let women vote because, and this I think ignores the gender dynamic in most households. I don't know how it is with Sylvia, but my mom has told my dad how to vote on occasion and me how to vote on occasion. But they said a man with a wife would have 2 votes, so that wouldn't be fair. They said that we need a poll tax because a man who can't afford to pay the tax, well, his vote can be bought. They said we need a literacy test because a man who can't read, His mind is not his own. And now they say that we need voter ID, even though you are more likely to know somebody who has been struck by lightning in the same place twice than find a prosecutable case of voter fraud, because we're afraid that our elections will be stolen. And so be very clear, when you hear somebody talk about vote security, what is, you scratch the surface, you find somebody who's actually anxious about actual democracy.
But Ken, let me ask you this one. What are the real threats to public safety in 2015? I mean, it was a time when we worried about organized crime, we worried about people who were murderers and bank robbers. What do you consider the greatest threat to the general public, to African Americans, to Latinos? Is it terrorism? Is it drugs? Is it gangs? Is it the proliferation of dangerous weapons? Is it racism? What do you consider the worst threat?
So I think first, from a national point of view, I think terrorism and national security concerns, which you obviously know a lot about, having been CIA Director, Secretary of Defense, that's just a reality. You know, I spent a lot of time in New York and walking around what used to be the World Trade Centers and seeing that reality that struck the United States there. And obviously Commissioner Kelly lived through that period as well. But I think that is just a reality for us in terms of making sure that that's one of the issues which at the national level, but it also involves having the right kind of collaboration and cooperation with local law enforcement and state law enforcement, has got to be one of the things that we look at in terms of our security. If we're not secure in our homes and our communities, then it's a huge problem. I would say the second issue really is the violence and crime that comes because of the drug epidemic that we have in the United States of America. I mean, when you look at what's happened in terms of those who are now filling our prisons, whether it's in the state of Colorado or New York, California, most of them and many of them are people of color, are there because of drug offenses. And so how we take a look at these issues as a society to try to address the danger of drugs and the scourge that it is in our society is something that we need to struggle with. You know, in my own home state today, we are the tourism capital of the world. Yes, because of the great Rocky Mountains and the Rocky Mountain National Park, but also because we've legalized marijuana in our state. So everybody from all across the country is coming to Colorado to buy a lid or whatever they buy to take across state lines, okay? So, there is danger in how we approach all these issues, but it has implications beyond our communities where so many of our young people and not so young people are actually the victims of a drug program here in the United States of America that doesn't work, and then it ends up having international implications on the narco trafficking realities that we're dealing with in Central America and in Mexico and South America. So I would say the drug issue probably is one of the largest issues that we need.
Ray, what do you think? Greatest threat?
I think a little bit of everything you said, but I think cybercrime is an issue, and it'll only be getting more problematic for us. We saw, you know, some major intrusions. We saw the Sony intrusion, Target, that sort of thing.
So correct.
It's only going to get worse. It's more complex than ever. I think FireEye said that they had something like 500 million varieties of malware that they have identified, and the term zero-day attack means it's a new iteration of malware. So if you look at the cyber threats just from stealing property, that's big. But you have to look at it also in terms of a terrorist event. We have not seen a successful cyber terrorist attack. But quite frankly, we see how sophisticated Iran is. We see the Russians. We see China. With North Korea, with great skill in this area. So I think as we defend ourselves against terrorism, we have to factor in the cyber threat. It's very, very difficult for us to defend ourselves. We can offensively shut down virtually any country we want, but in terms of defending our companies, defending ourselves, very, very difficult. I think the government has to get much more proactively involved to help key industries defend themselves. But you mentioned terrorism, ongoing threat, going to be around for a long time to come. We see ISIS, we see al-Nusra, we see al-Shabaab in Somalia making threats against shopping centers, that sort of thing. So that's going to go on. ISIS is a bit of a game changer. They're using the concept of a caliphate as a marshalling tool. Volunteers are coming in still from all over. It's going to be with us for quite a while to come. And I think also, as Ken said, I think depending on the neighborhoods, depending on the cities, if you're a young male, particularly a young male of color, you have to be very concerned about violence, gun violence.
Ben, this next question. How much of the racial inequality in this country is caused by income inequality? And how much of the income inequality is caused by racial inequality?
And if I had the answer to that, you know, look, I think actually the two questions go very well together. I would associate myself with all the comments that the commissioner and the senator made. With that said, poverty, I think, is one of our biggest threats in this country. The widening chasm, the loss of hope. We are living in a time when we will see artificial intelligence not just replace a high percentage of blue-collar jobs, but a high percentage of white-collar jobs as well. And anybody who understands the history of instability in societies, when you see that happen, when you see both the ambitious kind of bourgeois hit hard times and huge numbers of people stuck in poverty, we have to be concerned about the very fabric of our country. The American dream is what has really kept us stable, if we're honest with ourselves, and we have to maintain access to it and understand that's part of a homeland security strategy. With that said, our country, part of our issue here, and you see it when you go to England, you know, I was a student in England, when you travel through England, people are very comfortable talking about class. You can talk all day about class. They get really contorted when you try to talk about race. And yet they have a long history with race. I mean, like, you could kind of say, in the English-speaking world, they were sort of the origin of a lot of our issues, right? From India to America. In this country, you come back and you realize, oh, we're just the opposite. We're really comfortable talking about race. We're not so comfortable talking about class, and we pay a price for it. If I were to tell you right now, there's a group in this country who is almost as likely to be incarcerated as black men in South Africa at the height of apartheid, when South Africa was the world's leading incarcerator. You might think I was talking about blacks or Latinos. I'm talking about white men. But we don't talk about the plight of poor whites. And the bottom line is that I believe that going forward, affirmative action in the corporate sector needs to go the way that it has on college campuses. And college campuses, if we're honest, we have basically three lenses. We have a race lens, we have a gender lens, and we have a poverty lens. So you have special programs, people first generation college, for instance. People who, you know, if you come from Appalachia, it's a lot easier to get into Harvard than if you come from New York City or from the Upper East Side, for example, private school. So it should be. We need to add a poverty lens to affirmative action in our country. We need to be really get more comfortable talking about poverty. We need to admit that we have places like Eastern California where whites have been stuck in poverty for generations, just as they have in Appalachia. And we need to actually admit that this country, yes, has a legacy of slavery, but it also has a legacy of indentured servitude. And we have states like Georgia where whites came over as part of a penal colony. And some of those families, if we're honest with ourselves, have been in and out of prison ever since. And when we can have that conversation, then we're actually talking about the need to include and create ladders of opportunity, not for kids who look this way or look that way, but for virtually all of our children, given where we are right now.
Let me just say, Leanna, to add to that point, I very much agree with what Ben says, that we need to have lenses that include poverty. If you're impoverished, white person from Appalachia or somewhere in California, wherever you are, there ought to be those ladders of opportunity that we're creating. I've spent most of my life in the natural resources and environmental and political area, and I can tell you, in the environmental community, doesn't matter what organization, national organization you're part of, you address the group, and I've addressed them many times, there's not a single person of color in the entire room. I'm on the board of a major corporation. I go to corporate board meetings and see members who are CEOs and management people from major companies around the country. And frankly, there's almost a complete absence of African Americans, Latinos, who are in those worlds. So, I mean, my own view, and this is, I think, the vision that we all share up here, and that is that we still have a long ways to go to create this inclusive America, but it has to be in all sectors. It can't just be in education. It just can't be addressing the police forces of the country and try to have inclusiveness there. It has to be in corporate America, and it has to be in all sectors of our life, because I think it's been captured by the other speakers here. The reality of it is that the way the United States of America is going, I mean, you look 300 million people today, you start looking at where we're gonna be in 20 and 25 years, there's not gonna be a single majority. You know, today, Latinos constitute, I think, 54 million people in the United States of America today. Okay, that's all gonna change rapidly in the next 20 years. And so how we as a society evolve to make sure that whenever we're hanging around, doesn't matter whether it's in the corporate boardroom or whether it's in the police commissioner's office with his managers and his folks, that it's a society that reflects the population of this country.
Along those lines on diversity, Ray, the issue of increased diversity in the police force has been brought up several times in terms of specific policy recommendations. How can we go about making the police force more diverse?
Well, as I said before, I think we've done it in New York, but it took a lot of hard work, a lot of effort, cost money to do that. And sometimes you use people who you bring into the department. They see it as being a welcoming institution, and they go out and do the recruitment for you. I think we have to focus, I think law enforcement in general, or the federal government, has to focus on those smaller cities. I think the medium-sized cities, larger cities, are certainly engaged in recruiting, trying to recruit a police force that reflects the population that they serve. But the smaller towns, we talked about this before, we need consolidation. There's too many police departments in the country. There's about 18,000 law enforcement entities. Most of them have less than 20 police officers. That means, generally speaking, those citizens are not getting the services that they need, or they're not getting them quickly enough. Ferguson is an example. Of course, everybody's beating up on Ferguson. But I think the focus has to be with those smaller departments. You urge consolidation, and you urge minority recruitment. You do it through incentives. You do it through monetary incentives, programs coming from the federal government. It's an important issue, and it needs money.
Speaking of education, obviously, we know Brown versus the Board of Education determined that separate schools are inherently unequal. And my job as director of the Office for Civil Rights was basically involved in trying to desegregate schools that had been, by law, separated white from black kids. We've gone through a lot of work. And yet, if you look at recent studies, they indicate that there's resegregation going on. New York City is now considered one of the most segregated school systems, both in terms of race as well as in terms of poverty. If that's true, I mean, if we're seeing more, resegregation in this country, how are kids going to get a good education if they are in segregated schools? I mean, how do you break that cycle?
You know, the education quality and integration are both disconnected and related, right? I mean, you can have a great college like Morehouse College, for instance, it's all black, or Harvard was a good school when it was all white. But the reality is that what we know is that every child benefits who's in a school, it's more racially mixed. They learn a lot more about sort of cultural competence, problem solving, being able to actually get along with other people, things that seem intangible but pay off big dividends when you find yourself running a corporation or you find yourself working a beat. At the same time, what we have to really be concerned about, the real question is, how do we become a nation? Right? How do we mature as a nation? How do we be that place that Frederick Douglass described when he said, you know, every nation has a destiny. It's a paraphrase from a speech, Our Composite Nationality. Every nation has a destiny. And its destiny is unique, and it's shaped by its character and its geography. Its character is defined by that nation at its best, not its worst. Charitable words from a man who had been tortured as a slave. And our geography is unique. We are bordered by friendly nations, north and south, and oceans, east and west, that connect us to every other continent on Earth. And our destiny, based on our character, shaped by our geography, is to be the most perfect example, this part's exact quote, most perfect example of the unity and dignity of the human family that the world has ever seen. So the question is, how do we get there? And reality is that education resegregation is hard to tackle because it follows housing trends. And so there's a lot of things that have to click, really, to get that right. What can we do in the meantime? We need compulsory national service in our country.
Yeah, God bless you. That's great.
That's the simplest thing we can do.
No, absolutely. I agree with that. I think we need to get everybody to commit 2 years of service to this country, and it can be in different areas.
Right. And as with the military, which is our best engine of integration, people will come out, quite frankly, more connected, more feeling more American, and more readily recognizing who their fellow Americans actually are, i.e. not just people who look like them, but who look like the people they serve with.
Great. So I would say, Leon, if I may add to that, so I was one of the lawyers in the Keyes case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court issue of segregation in the northern states, where you didn't have a law that said you had to have separate schools for blacks and whites and browns in Denver, Colorado. By policy, the school board, without a law, they had established a system where you had brown schools, black schools, and white schools. So you get to the late 60s and the 1970s, and the Supreme Court addresses the issue of segregation and desegregation with the instrument of busing, and causes the reaction of white flight and all that's happened to many of the schools in the country that ended up essentially becoming resegregated. Because you had white flight taking the white students either to private schools or to schools off in the suburbs. So the reality of it is, and it hasn't happened everywhere, I can tell you that in Denver, for example, East High School used to be mostly, and Manual used to be mostly African American. Today, they're very diverse schools, and in part it's been because of the demographic changes and good things that happened from that chapter of the struggle for civil rights. But I would say the question for us today in 2015, where we have resegregation in a lot of communities in all the 50 states across the country, is how do we create new instruments to try to bring communities together from different backgrounds? To Ben's point, I think when you get to meet people from different backgrounds, when you go to school with them from different backgrounds, you achieve the kind of diversity that the military has achieved, but which you sometimes don't see in public education. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor was, you know, one of my favorite justices, and I was part of the University of Michigan affirmative action case, where she wrote the Supreme Court decision upholding the University of Michigan's affirmative action program. Now, as a Republican, appointed by Ronald Reagan, writing the opinion, and in the first page of the opinion, she speaks to the national security of the country in furthering diversity and affirmative action, and points to a brief that had been filed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff because national security required diversity. She continues on by saying global diversity is also very important for our country and its future, and cites to a brief that was filed by 30 companies from the Fortune 500 companies, and then continues on in her statement about how the United States, just to be strong, needs to have this kind of diversity across the board, which is what the University of Michigan was trying to do. That decision has been somewhat watered down since then, but I think that how we continue, whether it's here in Monterey, the way you're doing with this program today, or wherever we are, to try to figure out how we bring people from different backgrounds together so that they see each other as human beings, and that we all have. I used to make this argument when I was running for office, and people would ask me about diversity and how I saw diversity. I would say we ought to be in a position where we as a country should celebrate our diversity. We should not just tolerate our diversity, we should celebrate it. And the way you celebrate your diversity is if you understand each other and you know the history of different people from their backgrounds. Because at the end of the day, no one's history and no one's background is better than anybody else's or worse than anybody else's. But the only way you can get to understand that is if you are able to have the kinds of conversations we're having here tonight.
Ray, let me ask you, there are several cards on this. What is the use of force policy with regards to the police? And let me ask you also, how do you feel about requiring police officers to have cameras on their bodies?
Use of force policy, generally speaking, is a continuum. Most police departments teach that. You use your voice, verbal commands, that sort of thing, pushing, and then if you know the threat continues, you use less than lethal weapons. There are tasers now that many officers have, not all, many officers. And then, of course, there's deadly force with a handgun. That can change very quickly depending on the threat that an officer faces. The use of force is controlled by the Supreme Court case, Tennessee versus Garner, a 1985 case. And that decision held that police officers can only use deadly force on a fleeing individual if, in fact, that a person, the reason to believe that that person is going to use deadly force against them or against another person. Obviously, if you look at the video from North Charleston, South Carolina, obviously that was violated. So there is a continuum, and again, deadly force, generally speaking, is only used if deadly force is coming at you. As far as cameras are concerned, I think, again, referring to the video from North Charleston, anybody who sees that video has to think that that officer who was an officer for 5 years, had a relatively unremarkable record, would not have done what he did if, in fact, he was wearing a camera. So I think as a result of that one event, you will see a major move towards the utilization of cameras in some way, shape, or form, maybe a pilot program, maybe something more than that, by police chiefs across America. They don't want to be caught short. Now, everybody above the age of 10 has a video, you know, in their phone. So officers are, they realize that when they're engaged now in event, or they should, maybe the helicopter was an exception. When they're engaged in something, chances are they're going to be videoed. So it's almost a defensive mechanism now. So I think it will be, again, as a result of that South Carolina event, more accepted. There's lots of problems with videos in terms of storage, in terms of who gets access to them, FOIA requests, that sort of thing, but we're going to see that move soon.
We've got just a couple of minutes here, but I want to ask each of you very quickly, I mean, what is the one thing you think is most important to restore, to make sure we restore trust between the community and the police department?
I think we need to get officers out of their cars, talking to people in every community that they serve. We need to make sure that the officers are required to live in the cities in which they serve, and we really should actually, frankly, seek to recruit officers from the neighborhoods that they serve in the biggest cities.
Ray?
Yeah, I would say communication, and that's some of what Ben said, talking to communities, having police officers interact with communities, particularly communities of color, and having a police force that represents the communities that they serve.
Ken?
I would say representation, so you have police forces that reflect the community that they're responsible for policing. And then second of all, training, but real training, authentic training. And that's not just a check the box kind of thing on civil rights, but it has to be the kind of training that gets into cultural sensitivity and understanding the reality of different communities, because there's lots of training programs out there. I think probably every police officer goes through some kind of training program on cultural sensitivity, but the reality of it is that there's few programs that actually are very good, and that's what I think is that.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, this is obviously a topic we could spend a lot more time on, but it goes to the heart and soul of what this country is all about in terms of our relationships with each other, with the relationship between the races, and how we are able to deal with our freedoms and our security at the same time. I am hopeful that we will find the right answers, because I've seen men and women in uniform, different colors, different races, who are willing to fight and die for this country. And if they're willing to do that, we ought to be willing to do the same thing for the peace and prosperity and freedom that all of us enjoy in this country. Thank you, our speaker.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.